you are standing and confessing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing educators and activists to campuses and communities across America to engage in meaningful dialogue about the pressing issues that confront our country and the world. If you enjoy the program, one way you can express your support is to become a monthly patron and sustainer of the show by signing up at www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can pledge as little as $2 a month or as much as you'd like, and not only know that you're supporting our efforts, but also gain access to bonus content, like premium commentaries on the events of the week, as well as signed books or DVDs. And all donations are tax deductible as they go directly to Speak Out to support their nonprofit activist mission. You can also make a one-time donation to the program at speakoutnow.org via PayPal, and make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Because it's summer, I'm going to be taking a break from putting up new guest interview shows for the next 6 weeks or so. But never fear, the show must go on, and so I'll be posting compilations of the best of my older Patreon commentaries from late 2017, which most of you haven't heard before, but which still retain their timeliness. I'll be combining two or three of these each week with related themes or topics into a full program, and I'm sure you'll find them interesting. They'll also give you a sense of the kinds of bonus content I post at Patreon, which you can gain access to in a more timely fashion by signing up as a patron there, rather than having to wait 6 months or so to hear them as part of a compilation like the one I'll be posting today. On today's episode, two commentaries from 2017 addressing the way that racism operates systemically and structurally, even without the necessary presence of deliberate intent or bigotry. The first is a primer on institutional racism. What is it? How does it operate? And why does it remain such a problem in America? The second looks at gentrification and the way that so-called neighborhood revitalization often goes hand in hand with the marginalization of people of color, and how we might create more equitable communities in which both economic vitality and racial and economic equity can coincide. So take a listen and check out the show archives on Patreon, Podomatic, or through a podcast directory like iTunes. So it is very apparent to anyone who pays attention that people on the right in this country have an incredibly difficult time getting their head around the issue of institutionalized racism, what it is, how it's operating, when it's operating, and why those of us on the left and within the anti-racism and civil rights community make such a big deal out of it. I cannot tell you how many times I have been asked to show one example, they'll say, give me one example of rights that black people don't have that white people have. Give me one example of a right that black people are denied via institutional racism. But of course, it's an incredibly disingenuous argument. The issue is not, in fact, never has it been, what rights people have in theory or on paper. The question is how those rights are protected and enforced in practice. I mean, African Americans had the right to vote officially and legally, not because of the Voting Rights Act, but because of something that took place a century before. The 15th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States said that the right to vote could not be abridged on the basis of race. But it was 100 years later when we get the Voting Rights Act because, in spite of the technical right to vote, states had created a number of policies, practices, and procedures to subvert that right in practice. Grandfather clauses, poll taxes, things that made it incredibly difficult for African Americans to vote in practice, even if in theory that right had been vouchsafed. Due process is another example. Due process is mentioned in two different constitutional amendments. And yet over the years, the courts had to flesh out what that really meant in practice, right? In theory, you could not be deprived of your life or your liberty without due process of law. But the courts have had to offer various procedural changes and interventions over the years to make that actually mean something. So the reading of a criminal suspect's rights, for instance, is now part of understood due process. The right to counsel is something that is now understood as part of due process that wasn't necessarily fleshed out in the original writing of those constitutional amendments. So rights can exist in theory, but not necessarily in practice. The 14th Amendment guarantees equal protection of the laws in theory, but remember that amendment was around for 100 years before we get the Civil Rights Act that actually tried to make it more real in practice. If people of color are not being treated equally by agents of the state, like law enforcement, for example, then the fact that they have the right to be treated equally doesn't really mean anything. The problem with conservatives is they are looking at formal laws against, let's say, discrimination, as if those were sufficient, even though they know that's not true. It's certainly not true in criminal law. They would never make the argument there, would they? They would never say, well, it's enough that we have laws against murder. We don't actually have to enforce the law. We just got a law. Everything's fine. Nobody gets killed anymore, right? People get robbed and they get killed and they get raped and banks get held up. People get carjacked in spite of the fact that it's illegal to do all that stuff, right? Obviously, laws themselves are not enough. We still have to enforce them. And if you think about civil rights law, given the punishment for violations, there really isn't any real deterrence to discrimination. I mean, the average company that's fined for a civil rights violation is fined less than $1,000 on average. The reason it's so low is some companies get fined bigger. Lots of them don't get fined at all. Comes out to about $1,000 or less for a violation. So that's not much of a deterrent. And the odds of even being caught in the first place are minimal. Several years ago, came across a piece of data for my book on affirmative action, which granted is 12 years old, but I doubt that this data's changed any. At the time, the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, these are the folks that monitor compliance with things like civil rights laws for government contracted companies, found that the OFCCP only had enough monitors working checking up on potential violators to investigate each workplace once every 46 years or something like that. So that's not much of a deterrent to discrimination. If I know the odds of me being caught are virtually non-existent, and I know that even if I am caught, I'm only going to be fined $1,000 or a couple $1,000s, what in the world is my incentive not to just do what I've always done? If I have any level of prejudice at all, I might as well just go ahead and indulge it because there's not much you're going to do to me. In fact, there have only been 65 companies or something like that in the history of civil rights law that have been debarred for violating civil rights. Debarred means that you're not allowed to bid on government contracts anymore. 65 companies. Now, we all know there have been more than 65 companies that have engaged in discrimination, but only 65 of them have actually been told, yeah, that's it. You're done. We're not going to contract with you anymore. So even basic conservative deterrence theory, which they love when it comes to criminal law, that's why they want harsh punishment and lots of cops and let's lock them up and throw away the key because that deters crime. Well, obviously that theory fails here because enforcement is minimal. The right is basically just acting on the basis of a belief that passing laws alone when it comes to civil rights was sufficient to change hearts and change minds. And as a people, we've evolved so much in 50 years. Now we're at a place where no one's racist anymore. No one's racist except, of course, Barack Obama for the tanning bed tax that he imposed, which is something lots of white conservatives actually said on talk radio. That was racist because he's trying to tax white people for trying to get tans and he's just taking it out on whitey, right? No one's racist except Barack Obama. No one's racist apparently except people of color when they point out racial inequities. That's what makes them racist, but nothing else is in their mind. So obviously what we need to do is we need to broaden our understanding of what institutional racism is, because I think this fundamental misunderstanding, and maybe I'm giving conservatives too much credit, I think they know exactly what they're saying and they're being deliberately disingenuous, but just in case there are folks out there who are confused, let's have a deeper understanding of what we mean when we say institutional racism. Yes, it can be something formal, like Jim Crow segregation laws, like extrajudicial lynching, like the system of enslavement, but it can also be something very informal. Really, when we talk about this thing called institutional racism, what we mean is any racially disparate treatment that is perpetuated within an institutional setting. And sometimes that stuff isn't formal. Sometimes it's very informal. So let me just give you a few examples. And I don't expect everyone to automatically agree with what I'm saying. But it's important for you to know at the very least what it is we mean so that if we're going to have a conversation about institutional racism, we're all operating with a similar language and a similar understanding of concepts. So I'm going to talk about it in a couple different areas. First, the job market. When we think of institutional racism in the job market, people on the right would say, well, it's against the law. There isn't any. It's against the law to discriminate. Yes, there's no formal institutional racism in the job market because technically now that is illegal. But think about all the ways that racial disparity can be perpetuated, whether deliberately or not, by various institutional mechanisms. One of the most obvious, I think, that we all can probably readily get our head around is the notion of the old boys network. We know from the research going back decades that a disproportionate number of the jobs in the American job market are filled first and foremost by way of connections, who you know, not what you know, right? And there was a study just a few years back, got a little bit of national attention, not as much as it should have, but it found that almost half of the new jobs in the post-recession economy were being filled by one particular form of networking. About 46% of the new jobs were being filled by way of letters of recommendation written by existing employees on behalf of people who were aspiring to work at a certain company. So in other words, if you knew Jim over in the HR department, he could write a letter for you and you had a better chance of a job, right? If you knew someone over in accounting, they could write a letter, put in a good word for you. And these letters of recommendation, companies were increasingly, post-recession, they have been turning to that as a way to cut down their job search costs. They're even in some cases, you can get bonuses. If you bring in new employees, they'll actually pay you bonuses for that. So there's this incentive to use the existing employee networks to find new people. Now, in and of itself, that's not a racist thing. The problem is that in practice, when we hire based on connections and networks, we end up replicating the racial disparities that already exist in the workforce. Because even if, let's say, Jim over in HR isn't a bigot at all, he's not a Klansman, he's not an overt racist or a hateful dude. It's just he lives in a neighborhood that's virtually all white. You know, he goes to a church that's pretty much all white. His social networks are pretty much all white because we do live in a society of deep racial division. Something like 85% of white folks live in communities where they're virtually know people of color around. So even if you're not a bigot, you just don't have that many connections of people who are different than you. And that means the networks that you're part of and the people who you can then recommend for a job are going to be a lot like you. So even if there's no deliberate racism, there's going to be a racially disparate impact that is going to exclude disproportionately people of color. And that's what the study found, was that overwhelmingly the people who benefit from these old boys networks are white and they're male and they're upper middle class, by the way, and went to the quote unquote right colleges, which means that you could be the most qualified person for the next job at so-and-so company, but if you're a person of color, if you're a woman of any color, if you're a working class white dude, you are probably not even going to be in the competition. You're scratched from the beginning. It's not just that you're starting out behind in the race. You don't even know where the track is, and the people who are putting on the race don't know who you are, right? So that ends up perpetuating racial inequality, gender inequality. So when we talk about institutional racism or institutional sexism, that's what we mean. It may not be deliberate. It's not the kind of racism that we think of as bigotry. But is that not problematic? Do we not want to concern ourselves with these informal mechanisms that perpetuate disparity and hurt some people disproportionately and help others? A second thing, even more basic within the job market. Think about the way that we claim jobs ought to be filled. Yes, most people, you know, how should we fill jobs in this country? They're going to argue, and not just conservatives, everyone's going to more or less say, well, the most qualified person should get the job. And in theory, that makes perfect sense. Of course, the problem is, A, you know, how do we determine qualifications? That's a very subjective thing. Some people are going to emphasize one thing, other people are going to emphasize another. But B, even if we had a consistent way of doing it, it could be problematic because look, when it comes to qualifications, sometimes we get qualifications confused with credentials, and credentials are what you see on a resume. Credentials are what you see in front of you, the years of experience, right? The amount of experience that you've had, the seniority that you've had, maybe some of the letters of reference that you have or your references that can be checked on by a potential employer. And although all of that makes sense, in theory, yes, your years of experience obviously is going to matter. How much experience you've had, the quality of your experience matters, and we expect employers to think about it. But understand, even that can be problematic for the obvious reason that if certain people have had a chance to get into the pipeline earlier, let's say, and have had better connections and have had the ability to develop those credentials, and other people disproportionately have not had the same access, then the first group is going to have better resumes. than the second group, right? It's like having an 8-lap relay race. If I have a 5-lap head start in an 8-lap relay race, I'm supposed to cross the finish line first, but it doesn't mean I'm really the fastest runner when I do. In fact, I, with a 5-lap head start, what if at the end of the race I'm only up by 3 laps or 4 laps or 2 laps? By definition, I'm not the fastest runner. The other person was faster. They worked harder. They caught up. They closed the gap. And yet, I would still be deemed the winner. That's sort of how the job market works. So if white folks, and particularly white men, have had advantages in the labor market historically, and no one with any sense denies that, no one who's remotely capable of entering this conversation is going to deny that, then of course, they are going to have better looking resumes. They're going to have quantitatively more experience, but that doesn't automatically mean they're more qualified. So if we don't have a more holistic understanding of what it means to be qualified, like for instance, if we don't include the issue of, let's say, how far has a person come relative to their starting point, if we don't consider overcoming obstacles and barriers a qualification on par with the years of experience someone's had, then what we're doing is we're punishing the people who started out the race 5 laps behind, and we're rewarding the ones who started out the race 5 laps ahead. And that's going to mean what? Men as men, white folks as white folks, upper middle class folks based on socioeconomics. So once again, you can have institutional injustice being perpetuated against people who are every bit as capable, but who, because of these systemic background factors, are not in a position to look as good on paper. Think about schools. We are increasingly a society, more so than really any other on earth, that places emphasis on standardized testing, right? And we start doing this at a very, very early age in this country. But what does standardized testing do? Well, you know, it can give you some insight into where a kid is relative to other students in the class. And under the best of circumstances, that's what standardized tests do. Under the best of circumstances, it can allow a teacher, it can allow a school, it can allow a whole school system, it can allow a nation to say, hey, you know what, we're not doing right by these kids. How do we improve the opportunities for them? How do we make sure they're getting the lessons? Da 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 da. How do we, you know, what kind of reforms do we need to make sure that we close these gaps? But the problem is we don't just use it for that. We don't just use it as a diagnostic tool to help us get better. We use it as a gatekeeping mechanism to determine how far a kid's going to be able to go, to see if they're even going to graduate from high school, let alone get into college, let alone what kind of college or grad school or med school or law school. When you use these things as gatekeeping mechanisms in a society where not everyone has had the same opportunity to accumulate that particular credential, once again, you're punishing some and advantaging others. And if the people of color in this country who go to schools that are 10 to 12 times more likely to be places of concentrated poverty, which is the truth in this country, then take those standardized tests, they're not going to do as well as the kids who are white and went to schools that were 1/10 as likely to be places of concentrated poverty. If the white kids in our K through 12 institutions have been twice as likely to have the most experienced teachers, half as likely as kids of color to have had the least experienced teachers, which is also true, then they're probably going to do better if they're 3 times as likely to have access to advanced placement and honors courses and enriched curricula. They're going to do better than the black and brown kids who did not have that, right? So fundamentally, standardized tests are not, you know, on their face racist, but in a society where we're starting out at such uneven starting points and then using these standardized tests as gatekeeping mechanisms for the next level, then what we're doing is we are fundamentally perpetuating that injustice. So that too becomes a form of institutionalized racism, where certain people are going to be advantaged, not because they're necessarily better or more capable, but because they were placed 5 laps ahead of others in the 8-lap race. Think about policing. Same thing is true with things like stop and frisk. Theoretically, you could justify stop and frisk in any high crime neighborhood without a racial motivation. So you could argue, for instance, well, you know, stop and frisk, we should do that in all high crime places and including high crime, low income white places. And there are certainly places like that. But two things worth noting. Number one, we usually don't apply it in that way. So even though, for instance, we know that white folks are just as likely, if not more likely, to use illegal narcotics than black folks, it's not white folks who were stopped and frisked. It's not white folks who are racially profiled. And secondly, even if we applied it to everyone, the reality is that disproportionately that kind of saturation policing would affect people of color, right? And even though you might have a non-racial justification for it, let's say, you know, just give you an example. We talk about saturation policing and stop and frisk in places like New York City, and all the defenders of it will argue, oh, well, you know, it's important. We got to bring down crime. Well, you know, first of all, the research found that crime dropped for reasons having nothing to do with stop and frisk. And since stop and frisk was eliminated by court injunction, crime has continued to drop in New York City. So clearly it wasn't stop and frisk that was the cause of the drop in crime throughout the 1990s and early 2000s. It wasn't that at all. But in any event, when you saturate a community like that, Even if you're doing it for reasons that are salutary, as in we're trying to catch the bad guys and actually protect the people in the community, you can make all those arguments. The problem is when you saturate police in a place like that, what's going to happen is inevitable. You're going to be more likely to find criminals in that area than you are in the area where you're not saturating, which means that even though there are white folks in the suburbs, white folks on the college campuses, white folks in rural areas, white folks in the city, for that matter, in whiter parts of the city, who are using drugs, for instance, just as often, you're not going to catch them. You're going to be catching the black and brown folks. That means they're going to be in the system. That means they're the ones who are going to jail. And then what that does is it perpetuates the mentality, the myth, really, that black and brown folks are the ones responsible for the drug problem. And then that feeds unequal policing and it feeds personal prejudice. So the problem with the policy, even if it's not deliberately racist, is it perpetuates a racial imbalance in terms of who's getting arrested for this particular kind of crime, who's getting incarcerated for this particular crime. That disparity then feeds the perception of who is the problem, which then feeds more disparate treatment. So it creates this unvirtuous cycle as a result of a policy which you can rationalize all day long on non-racial grounds, but the racially disparate impact it has contributes directly to racism. So that too can be a form of institutional racism, irrespective of intent. Voting is the same thing, right? You think about some of the attempts right now by people on the right to restrict voting. Limiting early voting is a good example. All these states, North Carolina, Texas, others trying to cut back on early voting, even though there's no evidence that early voting is being used for fraud, even though there is no evidence that there's an abuse within the early voting system, they're trying to cut back on it. Why? Well, the evidence says that in large measure in these states, it's because the folks using early voting are disproportionately Democratic constituencies. They're disproportionately people of color. They're disproportionately low-income folks. They're disproportionately students, college students, for instance. So that's part of why they're doing it, is a partisan reason. One of the arguments that the state of Texas made in justification of their early voting cutbacks was saying that, yeah, you know, it's for partisan reasons. It's not racial reasons, they said. It's partisan reasons, and therefore it's legitimate. We're trying to essentially keep Democrats from voting because that's not technically illegal. Of course, the reality is it does have a disparate impact, and that's why Texas was sued over this, and that's why other states have been. Because the people who are disproportionately voting early are, in fact, black and brown and young and working class. And so when you have a policy like that, even if you can justify it on non-racial grounds, even if you want to justify it on partisan grounds, if it obviously and predictably has a disparate impact, it's not like they didn't know that was going to happen. In North Carolina, the court said it was with surgical precision that the legislature was trying to make sure black people couldn't vote. If you're doing that and it's a foreseeable consequence, it is perfectly fair to call that institutional racism. You are trying to make sure that fewer black people vote. Now, if you go out there and do that deliberately, by saying black people can't vote or we're going to impose a poll tax, we would all know that that was institutional racism. The poll tax is a classic example of institutional racism. But if the poll tax, which was usually very small, by the way, it wasn't like a huge amount, it wasn't thousands of dollars, but it was still found to be unconstitutional and with good reason. It was imposing a burden on some that was not felt by others. It is understood now to be a classic example of institutional racism. But if it is, then why isn't having to get a photo ID the same? Getting a photo ID costs money. These folks who want everybody to have photo ID, they're not offering to go out and make it easy and cheap for people to do it. There's been research that finds that for some people, the amount of time and money that it takes to get off work, to go to the DMV, to get that ID, particularly for elderly folks who maybe, you know, were born at a time when they didn't have to have photo ID. It used to be you didn't have to have it. So a lot of older folks don't. And a lot of elderly black folks don't have their birth certificates, especially if they were born in the South. They don't have a birth certificate. Oftentimes, the records weren't kept very well for people of color. And the cost of trying to actually track down all this information, get this ID made, comes out on average to like over $150. That's far more than what the poll tax was. And yet we see the poll tax as an example of institutional racism. Well, if it was, then why isn't that? Well, it is. And it is, even if that's not the intention, even if your reason for supporting photo ID were actually about stopping voter fraud. And there's no reason to think that because the evidence of in-person voter fraud is absolutely infinitesimal in this country. But even if that were your real reason, if you're talking about a policy which is going to have such a disproportionate impact on black and brown people, and it's foreseeable that it's going to, because people of color and low-income folks who are disproportionately of color are far less likely to have that kind of ID, then it is perfectly fair to call that an example, as well as the limits on early voting, an example of institutional racism. So I just want us to have this more capacious, broad understanding. When those of us on the left talk about institutional racism, we are not suggesting that the law explicitly allows discrimination. We're fully aware the law does not. And we're also fully aware of the fact that the reason the law doesn't allow that is because people like us fought to make sure of that. It wasn't the right that was responsible for the eradication of Jim Crow segregation. It was the civil rights movement led by leftists and liberals, progressives in this country. So we're fully aware of what the law says. Thank you very much. And you can indeed thank us and our side anytime you feel like it. But let's be real clear, that's not the end-all be-all of fighting racism. Just because you have rights in theory, just because you have laws that guarantee equal treatment in theory, doesn't mean it's happening in practice. So if we have discrimination in the job market through these informal mechanisms like the Old Boys Network, if we have racism in the school system through the use of these things like standardized tests, which have such a disparate impact on people of color through no fault of their own, if we have practices among law enforcement which have a disparate impact on people of color, then it is perfectly fair and legitimate in those cases, as well as the voting rights cases, to call those institutional racism. It's perfectly fine if you want to disagree with those of us who make that argument about the extent of the disparate impact. If you want to make the argument that the disparate impact isn't really that big, then feel free to make that argument and present evidence to that effect. But we just want you to be very clear about what we mean. It's one thing to have a debate about the extent of that disparity. It is quite another to act as if such blatant racial disparities as this ought not be called racism. Of course they should be. Racism, by definition, ends with those letters ISM. It means that that's not just an attitude, it's not just an ideology, it's a system, as with other isms, capitalism, socialism, communism, fascism, and like any system, it is kept in place by a number of policies, practices, and procedures and norms, some of which are formal, some of which are informal. If the only ones you're looking for are the formal ones, you're going to miss the bigger picture. Now, my commentary on gentrification. There are very few words in the contemporary American lexicon that can as rapidly create tension, frustration, anger, evoke all kinds of emotions, and to some extent misunderstanding, perhaps, as the word gentrification. Wikipedia defines it as a process of renovation of deteriorated urban neighborhoods by means of the influx of more affluent residents. If you actually look up the dictionary definition, it's quite a bit more loaded, interestingly. It says, the process of renovating and improving a house or district so that it conforms to middle class taste. Lots to unpack there in both of those definitions. And I want to talk about this because, of course, there is also another way in which gentrification is defined. And it's defined by the way it's lived, right? A dictionary definition, a Wikipedia definition, can never really sufficiently encapsulate the meaning of a concept to the people who are experiencing it, right? A definition is just words. And they're words that are used by people. So when people write the dictionary definition, they're bringing their own perceptions to it. Gentrification also has a working definition, right? A working definition is a definition that is contextual, that explains a concept in the way that it is experienced in the real world. And in that regard, gentrification is often experienced as the pushing out of longstanding residents of a community, the displacement of and replacement of longstanding residents in a way that first and foremost transforms the demographic of a neighborhood, usually from working class to more affluent, oftentimes from a community of color to a whiter community. It's also a racial element that the definitions leave out in the American context. And it is a process whereby not just the demographic of the neighborhood, but the neighborhood itself is transformed culturally in a way that makes it really an entirely different neighborhood altogether. So gentrification has both an economic element and a racial element and a cultural element. And it is that level of push out, that level of replacement and displacement, that level of cultural transformation where longstanding residents often experience gentrification as a form of colonialism, as a form of conquest and displacement. And that may seem extreme to people who look at gentrification as a net benefit, right? They look at it and they say, but the neighborhood's getting better. You know, there's more jobs now. There's more economic activity. There's less crime. And oftentimes those things are true. and more jobs, more economic activity, less crime. Those are things that the residents of those communities have long wanted for their neighborhoods and have long fought for their neighborhoods. But I think it's important for those who support the process of gentrification and don't understand the pushback to understand the way it feels. The reason that I wanted to talk about it was because there was a story recently, a story in November that I saw originally on the AP wire, it made the New York Times and other national news, about a coffee shop in Denver, Ink Coffee. They have several locations in Aspen and in Denver, and the Ink Coffee near Five Points, which is a previously largely black neighborhood that has lately become one of Denver's trendiest neighborhoods, got in a bit of trouble. They displayed a sidewalk sign that said, quote, "happily gentrifying the neighborhood since 2014, end of quote. Coming in and bragging about, braying about gentrification and how they're happily contributing to it is, I think, particularly symbolic and important. So there was all of this backlash. There were protests outside the coffee shop. There have been various calls by council members and by the NAACP and others to require training for the employees. And the owner, the founder of the chain, has explained that it was part of an advertising campaign. And he originally said, in a way that was obviously quite clueless, that it was part of taking pride in being part of a dynamic, evolving community. But he went on to say he was embarrassed because he didn't, quote, fully appreciate the very real and troubling issue of gentrification. He went on to say, "I recognize we had a blind spot to other legitimate interpretations. I sincerely apologize, absolutely and unequivocally," end of quote. And then he went on to promise that he would educate himself and his colleagues about the issue. Couple of things that I think are worth pointing out. First of all, you know, this won't make sense to you, I suppose, and I don't know a lot about Denver, but I know enough to know a few things. And certainly if I lived out there and was going to open a business there, I would take it upon myself to know some things about the neighborhood into which I was moving. Five Points is a historically black neighborhood. It was once known as the Harlem of the West, because it was a place where jazz musicians would go and congregate and play. And today, part of that area has been rebranded, as often happens with gentrification, right? They change the names as a way to attract people who are afraid of the old name because of what they think it signifies. And so now part of it has been rebranded River North, the River North Arts District or something like that. Rhino, because they always want to take those names and give them these short little cutesy things like Soho, right? So now it's called River North or Rhino, and it's become a really hip, hot place, and it has come to symbolize a lot of what's going on in the Denver area, and not just in Denver. I mean, it's going on all over the United States. These areas that for years were working class and lower income, disproportionately black, and now are transitioning to more affluent hipster places and increasingly white. And if you go into the neighborhood in Denver, the historic Five Points area, you'll find that you've got cannabis shops because, you know, all the white folks are opening weed shops in Colorado, making, I should point out, millions and millions of dollars selling a product for which there are thousands upon thousands of black and brown folks doing time right now in Colorado prisons, right? Just because they didn't have an occupational license and a storefront. They were selling the same weed. And they're doing time in jail, rich white folks getting rich, setting up weed shops. They got weed shops in Five Points. They got breweries in Five Points, all these condos. And of course, you know, Ink Coffee. And as a result of the gentrification and folks moving into Denver in such large numbers, the estimates are there's like 1,000 families every month that are moving into to Denver. And the demand for housing has gone up to such an extent that both rent and property values have exploded. The median price, midpoint price of a single family home has doubled in just the past 5 years, now stands at about $450,000. That's the midpoint. That is beyond the reach of about half of the people who live in Denver, according to researchers at Harvard. So obviously is creating some real economic pressures on working class and low and moderate income folks. And so this coffee shop puts up this sign. There are all these protests. And I wanted to talk about it because there's, again, a lot of, I think, misunderstanding on the part of people who got very defensive on behalf of Ink Coffee. I do applaud the founder for being contrite enough to acknowledge his own shortcomings and his own blinders on this issue. Because, you know, it's real easy when somebody accuses you, in effect, of not necessarily being racist, but doing something racist, doing something colonial, doing something horrible, like hurting the people in the community. It's real easy to get defensive and pissy. He seemed to be making a sincere statement of contrition and apology and really hoping to learn something. And I hope that's the case because I don't expect this guy to understand what gentrification feels like from the other side. He is, by his own self-definition, a ski bum from Aspen. And, you know, I got to tell you, If you're a ski bum from Aspen, I'm assuming you didn't grow up poor. I'm assuming you didn't grow up struggling. You didn't grow up in neighborhoods like that. And you don't really think about what it feels like when you move into a neighborhood and you begin to transform it. And then especially when you have a sign that seems so dismissive of their concerns. So I'm going to cut him slack just so long as he proves himself to be sincere about wanting to learn and to listen. But what I think is interesting is a lot of people who got defensive on this guy's behalf. There were some articles that I read in the Denver Press afterward about this. There was one particular column where the author of the column was talking about, you know, what is the big deal? Because, you know, gentrification's great. I mean, the homeowners who are being quote-unquote pushed out, well, they're getting big payouts when they sell their homes to developers. So they're making bank. They're tripling, quadrupling their initial investment. Or, you know, the crime rates are going down. And they'll point out, as this one particular article did, that crime and neighborhood deterioration actually push out more people from a neighborhood than gentrification does. And it does so without any of the upside of gentrification, right? If you leave a neighborhood just because it's falling apart or because the crime rate's gone up, you're not getting to cash out. You're not getting any kind of benefit. You're just running, right? And of course, I mean, this argument's true to an extent. There are some problems with it though, right? Sometimes developers offer people pennies on the dollar for what they intend to charge once they clear your lot and they put up maybe two units on one lot. That's happened all over Nashville, right? They're offering pretty small amounts of money. Might seem like a lot of money if you're struggling, but it's still pennies on the dollar on one lot. And then they'll build two things called tall skinnies, right? These almost like double shotgun houses, just so you can squeeze them onto one lot and make more money. I'm not sure why we should consider profiteering like that as being some, you know, grand scale magnanimity, but that's what this article suggested, right? That the developers are helping the neighborhood. Well, they might be, but they might not be. But even when it's true that the homeowner, let's say, who is forced out, even when they do get a check for their property, what I think a lot of defenders of gentrification miss is, where do these folks go now? Because if the prices are exploding that much, and then you give them a check, and it might even be a decent size check, it may definitely be a major return on their investment 20, 25, 30 years ago. But now where do they move? Because all the other property in town has exploded as well. Now they can't afford to buy in the neighborhood they lived in before. They can't afford to buy in any of the other neighborhoods in the urban core, which are also generally gentrifying. So now they got to move to either lower income areas in the hood, or they got to move like 30 miles out. That's happening in Nashville, having to move 20, 25, 30 miles away from town, away from their friends, away from everything that they know. So where do they go? And if they only took that check from the developer because they couldn't pay the taxes anymore, how is that really any different than someone coming up to your car at an intersection, putting a gun in your face and carjacking you, and then maybe, you know, pulling out $500 out of their pocket and giving it to you because they're taking your BMW and they're figuring like, well, it's worth $500. If I carjack you and give you $500, I still carjacked you. And I didn't give you a whole hell of a lot of choice. Like, you either give me the car and I give you this $500 and you accept that, or I shoot you in the head. A developer's coming along and saying, you either take this $150,000, $200,000, $300,000, even though I'm going to make $1 million on your property, take this $300,000, or else you're going to get kicked out of your house anyway because you can't pay the taxes. I mean, to me, that's like a hostage situation. So I think it's just important to understand, like, that when you're looking at this issue from, you know, a very sort of stationary perspective as someone who's middle class or upper middle class, and, you know, frankly, also if you're white and you haven't been in a community that was mostly people of color that had a history and a culture that you really don't have any familiarity with, I think you need to be able to sort of put yourself in that place, right? And to try to understand it from the other side rather than making all these very traditional arguments, which make perfect sense to you, right? Well, it improves the property value. It, you know, crime drops, everything's good. I think this just is a very simplistic way of looking at it, right? It's not about whether the presence of white folks or upper middle class folks, regardless of color, or these businesses like Ink Coffee is a good or a bad thing. The issue is about what it means when a neighborhood that historically has been grounded in pride of place, even when the outside world hated it and feared it, begins to change and become hip all of a sudden, right? And the folks who were always there before it got cool, they look around and they start to wonder, you know, weren't we good enough before? Y'all looked at us like zoo animals before, but now y'all want to move in? Right? I mean, the issue is, what does it feel like to have tried for years to get better city services and more investment and capital into the neighborhood, or to get loans to start businesses, or in many cases, to actually have had businesses back in the day, which got knocked down to make way for office buildings and parking lots and interstates as a result of urban renewal, only to watch as, you know, newcomers who mostly don't look like you and don't have a connection to the community and whose parents and grandparents ran the hell away from that neighborhood, right? When they come back and they're able to get that capital and they're able to open that business and then they get the credit, right, for making the hood a decent place to live. That's the issue. It's not this company. It's not this coffee shop owner. It's not the sign. It's not about the owner being racist or an awful person. It's about what the sign represented to the people from that community who were there before it got hip and how it feels to basically have someone tell you, even if unintentionally, that your neighborhood sort of sucked until we got here. And we need to be able to think about how that feels, right? These developers need to think about how that feels. And those who were actively engaged in the process of gentrification, either as business owners or just as residents, right, moving back into these spaces, need to think about that. These are neighborhoods where we constantly are telling kids that their goal ought to be to escape. That's what we've told them for years, right? Not to stick around so they can make it better, not to stick around so they could fight for the resources that are lacking, but telling them, you know, stay in school, get an education so you can get out of here. We've been dissing this neighborhood, these neighborhoods for years, right? So they already know. Young people already know what folks think, right? When you say Five Points in Denver, historically, or when you say Bed-Stuy, thinking of Brooklyn, or when you say Roxbury or whatever in Boston, right? And then when you come in and you try to rename the neighborhood, which is also what happens, you know, you're saying, well, what you have been is so awful, so tainted, so toxic that it just can't be allowed to exist anymore. You know, when you start to think about it from that place, it becomes about a lot more than just, you know, neighborhood beautification, right? It has to be viewed in the larger context of urban renewal and change and transformation, which was never a colorblind process. And it was never sort of a class neutral process, right? Begins in the late 40s. People of color are acutely aware of this history because their families lived through it. A lot of white folks don't know this. But that context of urban renewal is a context within which Black people in particular were always seen as disposable, right? As fungible properties to be moved around for the benefit of progress, right? Gentrification is just sort of, you know, what it feels like to be a pawn in someone else's game rather than being in control of your own moves. And it's not affluent white folks' fault that they don't necessarily know what that feels like, because why would you in a lot of ways? We certainly don't talk about it in school, and if you haven't lived it, you're not going to know it firsthand. But it is the responsibility of such folks to learn and to listen and to really feel what they're being told by the folks who have experienced this in real terms. And I think about this, you know, because I lived in New Orleans for 10 years, and that's a city that, as much as any in the country, you know, has experienced this. When Katrina came through, I think a lot of folks who haven't spent a lot of time in New Orleans looked at that and thought, oh my God, you know, this is terrible. My God, people are being displaced. But, you know, that wasn't really new. And the Black folks in New Orleans might have been the only folks that weren't shocked by what happened, because being moved around, being dislocated, and then, you know, not being able to come back to your neighborhood, either because it's been destroyed to make way for, you know, shopping malls or interstates or office parks or whatever, or a Walmart, as happened in the area where the St. Thomas housing development used to be. That's normative, right? That's just been what Black folks have always experienced. I think a lot of white folks were stunned that could happen, but I don't think people of color were. And, you know, the story of New Orleans, if you spent any time there, you know that the Treme, which is the oldest free Black community in the United States, and beginning in the 1960s, there was a big debate in New Orleans about where to put the interstate, where to put the I-10, which is really the main artery that gets you in or out of the city of New Orleans. And so in the late 50s and into the early 60s, they start having this debate, and there were, you know, there were two things actually they were talking about. One was putting an off-ramp that would go through the French Quarter, and the historic preservationists, you know, who were mostly these rich white folks, were like, oh hell no, you can't rip up the quarter to make traffic easier. But they were able to plow the I-10 right through the Treme and the old 7th Ward, which was the old line Creole community in the city of New Orleans. And they put up these interstate stanchions and the overpass, and they ripped up a, you know, huge sort of public park, about a 6,200 foot long by 140 foot wide, what they call neutral ground. Others might call it a median in most parts of the country, but New Orleans, that's what we call it. And it was like a recreation place for folks in the neighborhood. They would have cookouts there and family get-togethers and swap meets and, you know, just all kinds of stuff that would be going on the weekends in this sort of public space. And the interstate took that away. And Black folks got, you know, thousands of residences were torn down. Businesses were knocked to the ground to make way for the interstate. And all of this was done so as to make it easier for white people to get to and from the city, because white folks had started to flee to the suburbs where only we were allowed to live, right? Where only our people were really allowed to go. And so interstates in places like New Orleans and other major cities were able to facilitate white flight. This was government financed as of, 1956, when President Eisenhower, initiates the Interstate Highway Program. This is government financed white flight, government subsidized racial segregation. It allowed white folks to get in and out of the city. And it meant that black folks had to double up in crowded apartments or maybe go into public housing for the first time. And so this is the context within which gentrification has to be understood, because the reason the neighborhoods became so economically decrepit was because of the choking off of capital, the urban renewal, which destroyed a lot of black and brown business districts in this country, and then the inability to get access to capital and credit. And so now when white folks are able to come back, having discovered that, actually the city is a lot more fun than your stale ass suburb, and we want to come back into the city to get our life, and it's hip now, and then they can come in and get the very credit that black folks were, being denied all those years. You got to understand there's a history there, right? And that urban renewal experience marks the way that black and brown folks are going to view so-called neighborhood improvement or economic development plans, right? If the development hasn't benefited white people and people with money, it hasn't been made historically, right? So if it's for corporate offices, if it's for malls, that's fine. If it's for interstates to get white people around, that's fine. If it's for white people who want to come in and be a part of urban renaissance, that's okay. But if it's for black folks who were there before, you can't have the same access. And we just need to be clear about it, right? We have to think about how it feels. If you stay in the community, let's say you're not one of the ones who's pushed out by gentrification, you stay, you fight, you want to stay in the community. But now, because you're surrounded by all of these upper middle class or affluent white folks increasingly coming in, now the police are looking at you funny and they're stopping you in the neighborhood you've been in for three generations because they think that your ass doesn't belong there. Right. And that happens, too. I mean, I've talked to plenty of folks in gentrified neighborhoods who are black and brown, and they're the ones getting stopped by cops who are protecting the newcomers from the folks who were always there. Right. So I think those who defend gentrification without thinking about these things in a complex way are really missing the way in which gentrification is a at best a double-edged sword, and at worst can be a form of marginalization and oppression. And with all that said, I'm not against the return of white folks and more affluent folks to the cities. I think that's far preferable to white flight and the insularity that comes with that. I fundamentally do believe in the importance of integration and mixed, income housing in communities and interracial contact and relationships. But we have to facilitate that process on a plane of equity and mutual regard, right? Regard for what folks can bring to the neighborhood, capital first and foremost, but also regard for what was already there. Good people with a history and a culture and a tradition of struggle and resistance and perseverance against long odds. And what that means is that newcomers who come to such spaces need to remember that we are joining their community rather than reinventing it or fundamentally transforming it, right? Those newcomers should be the ones who are striving, let's say when they start a business in that community and they set up shop there, they should be striving to hire people from that local community to work in the business. And they should be contracting whenever possible with local people of color owned companies for contract work, whether it's painting or construction or printing or demolition work or whatever it might be. Those newcomers ought to feel obligated to take up the issues the community was already working on before they got there, right? Fair housing, police misconduct, rent stabilization, whatever. Don't move in if you aren't ready to become an activist on behalf of the community. Because to do otherwise would be like moving to Birmingham, let's say in the 1960s in Alabama, and not taking up the cause of civil rights, right? Or to move to Johannesburg in the 70s and 1980s in South Africa and not take up the anti-apartheid cause. It's just wrong. Those newcomers have an obligation to fully integrate themselves into the struggle of the community, not just the geography, right? Those newcomers ought to be meeting with community folks and leaders before they set up shop and discussing with them their plans. How can we be responsive community members? What do you need from us and what do you not need from us? And those newcomers ought to commit to setting aside a portion of their profits for local community-based organizations. It also means that public policy in these cities needs to be crafted with an eye towards forcing the newcomers to bear the cost of gentrification rather than the folks who've been there. So that might mean that we protect longtime residents of a community with property tax freezes, freezing the property taxes at the level they were before the neighborhood got hip, right? And doing the same for landlords, creating incentives for landlords if you own, not if you're like a big developer or, landlord with hundreds of units. But if you're a small landlord who has, you know, a couple of units, two, three units, maybe five or less or whatever, you say, look, if you'll agree to keep your rents stable and only increase them by the, you know, the normal rate of inflation, then we'll also freeze your property taxes. If you're going to keep going up on your rent, we're going to make you pay more. We're going to try to create an incentive for you to keep rents down. Seems like that could be something we could do. Also some land use and zoning changes. You know, here in Nashville, I don't know how it is in Denver and other places, but in Nashville, you know, we have a rule that for every apartment unit and probably condo unit also, but certainly for every apartment unit, and they're building just a shit ton of apartments right now in Nashville. For every unit, you've got to have two parking spaces. And I mean, there are a couple problems with that. Number one is it, of course, contributes to the gridlock on our interstates and contributes to environmental problems because it makes people ever more reliant on automobiles. And it means that we don't have a lot of good public transportation. We're trying to fix that, but there's not a real clear concrete plan, in my estimation, about how we're going to do that. Partly it's because we're incentivizing automobile dependency. But the second thing it does, if you require two parking spots for every housing unit, you also take land out of circulation because you got to build parking lots and or garages. And when you take land out of circulation, the land that's left that people can actually live on becomes more expensive, and that's going to jack up the rent, and that's going to, you know. So once again, there's got to be public policy, but there's also got to be private awareness and a commitment to really thinking about this issue from the perspective of those who are experiencing it and have been experiencing transition and change generation in and generation out. And that transition and that change has so rarely benefited them that you really can't blame them when they look at your coffee shop or they look at your hot yoga studio or they look at your pottery studio and wonder whether you're really going to be a good neighbor or not. And I think if folks can begin to listen, as this coffee shop owner in Denver seems willing to do, then we can create economic development that really benefits everyone, and certainly the benefits of which are spread more evenly. But if not, we're going to have more conflict like this. And that conflict is not going to be the fault of the folks who were always in that neighborhood. They have a reason to be suspicious. They have a reason to be skeptical. They have a reason to be cynical. Maybe if we begin to work together, we can diminish the skepticism, diminish the cynicism, and we can build multiracial democracy in these spaces in our cities in this country. And that'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Join us again next week and every Tuesday through the summer for the best of my prior commentaries. And stay tuned for the next chapter of Speak Out with Tim Wise coming later this fall. You can also check out my essays at medium.com or my website, www.timwise.org, and follow the show on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Instagram. Take care and stop by again next week.